become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United archive.
Also, Owen Wilson, I hate to harp on the guy, but he's sort of in M. Night Shyamalan territory, which is people sort of see him. Well, they sort of see him.
I know what you mean.
He's given people a lot of turkeys, you know. I mean, he's put out a lot of really bad movies, to some pretty terrible ones, actually, and fairly consistently. And so he's to the point now, when you see him in a trailer, your eyes almost glaze over, and I can hear the audience going, oh, my God, you know, like, it's just like with the M. Night Shyamalan-produced movie, Devil, you know, the elevator movie. Like,
yeah.
People are totally into the trailer, and then they see M. Night Shyamalan, they're like, ah.
So they did that with you, too, because when we saw Scott Pilgrim, people just burst out laughing when his name came up.
Yeah, they do. But I feel like people do it with Owen Wilson movies, too.
Are we talking about, like, because he does stuff like Marmaduke and
Drill Bit Taylor.
Okay.
Marley
and Me was a big success.
The Marmaduke is a standout there outside of Wes Anderson, but yeah, I know what Chris is saying, though.
But that was because of the dog.
I think the dog, if you didn't have the dog in that movie.
And of course I'm talking about Jennifer Aniston.
I knew that was coming.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We are pleased to be with you tonight. It's a very special show for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, because we have someone new on the panel. You have heard him do interviews for us in the past, and now for the first time, our good buddy Tony Farinella is on the round table with us. Hey, Tony.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Of course.
Love having you. Just to let you know, Jerry and I like to talk, so just cut in anytime you feel comfortable.
Okay.
Because I know sometimes people are on the show and they're kind of skittish, like, I don't want to interrupt them. You'll just have to barge right in, buddy, okay? I give you permission.
I think tonight should be all right, though. I mean, I think tonight should be, I don't think it should be hard.
A little bit later on the show, we'll be playing interviews with two of the filmmakers from the VHS horror film anthology, Glenn McQuaid and Joe Swanberg. Both interviews of which Tony conducted for us. That'll be a little bit later on in the show.
I've been keeping up with Venice, sort of, you know, on a...
Uh-huh.
And I've been reading about The Master, but then I saw a headline today, people booed this Terrence Malick film?
Yeah, yeah.
What was up with that? I mean...
Yeah, exactly. But this isn't an atypical reaction to a Terrence Malick movie, necessarily. Booing and jeering. But I think it's going to fall just like Tree of Life did. People are going to despise it or people are going to love it. And there have been some critics that have come out and expressed both points of view.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood Reporter did not like it. They thought it was meandering and nonsensical. Meanwhile, people like IndieWire and a couple of other places just adore it. They
mm-hmm.
say this is a beautiful, transcendent, poetic movie that almost feels like an expansion of what Tree of Life started. In the fact that there's very little dialogue, it's very sensory, apparently Ben Affleck is only kind of a peripheral presence in the movie.
Yeah, they said the Bond girl is the main character. I read that earlier. She's the main character of the film. Olga Malenko is the main character in the film, supposedly. So that's a fascinating right there. I mean,
She was the only one that was there at the festival, too, from what I was reading. She was the only one that showed up for the festival. No Malik, which is no surprise because he's sort of a recluse, but there's no Ben Affleck and nobody else.
Isn't he in Colorado
very silent,
or
too.
Argo?
Yeah, Affleck's with Argo, but in Telluride. But Javier Bardem, Rachel McAdams wasn't on the panel, and her De Palma movie Passion is playing at Venice. So actually, in terms of actors, it was just Olga, I don't know her last name, but Olga, the lead.
Korolenko, I want to say, or something?
Yes. It was just her and another smaller part cast member and the two producers on the panel. And that was it.
Let me ask a dumb question. Are they going to release this year, or are they going to wait till next year?
Well, this is the big question. I mean, if the movie is more impenetrable than Tree of Life, it's going to – I mean, that's a hard sell. But it has international distribution. I think it's opening in some international territories on December 14th. It does not yet have U.S. distribution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this won't be till at least next year. So you could release this against G.I. Joe Retaliation. I don't think there'll be a problem.
From what I heard, the film is mostly silent as well. From what I heard, there's very little dialogue. I think it's mostly done in voiceovers from what I was reading.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lots of pastoral
If the first
imagery.
G.I. Joe was a silent, it would be a masterpiece.
I think he's talking about Through the Wonder.
No, I know that the first G.I. Joe is...
The sequel to G.I. Joe is completely silent. It's just the audience is completely silent at the G.I. Joe.
Exactly.
No, I kid. I mean, The Rock and Bruce Willis, it can only help that series.
Oh,
it can only
be better than the last one. I mean, Coffee Enema would be better than the last one. I have a clip from Olga, actually. Say the last name again, Jerry.
I want to say Korolenko or something.
Let's go with that.
We'll go with that.
I have a clip from her at the press conference at Venice talking a little bit about the way Terrence Malick works.
Terry's movies are very visual, and it all comes through image. And often what he told us, the actors, is that it's much better, he would just tell me, you know, throw away the words, don't speak, think them. And he's persuaded that it's much stronger. Sometimes silence is stronger than words. Actually, very often it is. And everything, I think, through the body, and that's what's remarkable about him, that he's able to portray, to tell you the story, to give you the emotions through the body, through the silence, through the eyes of people, the characters' faces, and there's no need for words. It's still, the message is still perceived, and you still feel it.
And that's probably more dialogue than is in the actual film.
I was going to say, I mean, my God, whoa.
She's a fountain of it. You know, this brings up an interesting topic, and we'll get back to a couple of the other higher-profile films that have premiered at Venice and Telluride in just a bit. But this is something that's interested me lately. As I expand my horizons in terms of the movies I've been investing time in, there is an argument to be made that, yes, story is the absolute essential. You can't make a great movie without being invested in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that especially with narrative cinema, I mean, that is the essential component. But there's also the idea that films can be more. I mean, they can be just an expression of an emotion or a sense of time and place, or they don't have to be, they don't have to follow a narrative beginning, middle, and end through line necessarily. I'm kind of opening myself to that notion, but I mean, those films are few and far between because most storytelling involves a story, you know, obviously.
Right.
The film is capable of so much more, but when you venture off into that territory, as Terrence Malick clearly does here and there, it's hit and miss. I mean, you really got to luck out to actually be successful at that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I agree with you. I think obviously Terrence Malick did it with Tree of Life. I think Lars von Trier did it with Melancholia. I think we see this time and time again with the really, I mean, look, today, earlier on Turner Classic Movies, The Black Stallion was on. And I think that's more a triumph of visual storytelling than anything else. And I know, I mean, it's a great on all levels, but it's really a visual feast for the eyes more than anything else. There's not that much dialogue. I think it's very interesting you bring that up because the other big film is a Paul Thomas Anderson film. And with obviously, if The Master, it seems like There Will Be Blood in some ways, it seems like the visual is just as important.
Well, that's one thing. I mean, for the visual storytelling, I mean, even De Palma does that. I mean, you get the sense that De Palma would like to throw away the dialogue just so he could tell his story on a purely visual level, and that's
at least he doesn't want to throw the actors away.
There's also not having a story, like a narrative that you follow, the beginning of the character, the conflict, the inciting incident, the conclusion. I mean, that kind of narrative I'm talking about.
Right. Okay. So are you talking like more like Pasolini and Antonioni and those kind of filmmakers, really?
Yes. Yes.
But I think you also have to have good performances outside of the visuals. I think visual can be great for a certain period of time, but if it's strictly visual, I think you have to have great performances. So you think of a film like The Artist, which there's very little, if at all, talking. It's a very visual film, but because the performances and the faces are so engrossing and so engaging, we sort of can overlook the fact that, yes, there is a story there, but there's a lot of talking going on. So I think if the story can be sort of less and less as long as the performances and the visuals kind of go hand in hand, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But with a really, truly masterful artist, and obviously I think you're getting at Kubrick too, you can... very few people can really do that. We have some right now who can. I think Malick can do that. I think Anderson can do that, and De Palma obviously.
I think Malick is trying to do that, and Kubrick always wanted to throw out the typical three act structure, but even so, his stories. You look at his stories, and while the stories themselves weren't of the utmost importance to Kubrick, it was more about capturing the essence of something. They do all have a clearly defined beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at a movie like Tree of Life, and I was just talking to my friend Aaron about this today, there was one critic that loves To the Wonder because it's what he thought Tree of... No, he loves another film that premiered there. Because another film that premiered there from the makers of that movie, Baraka...
Oh, yeah, and, yeah.
Yeah. Does not have a narrative. I mean, it is purely kind of a visual experience, and there's
mm-hmm.
not really a story that you follow from point A to point B. He thought the Tree of Life should have been more like that, as opposed to maybe 60% of that. But even if you look at Tree of Life and you think there's no story there, my point about Tree of Life is, first of all, it's hard not to have a story when you introduce a character and that character has a conflict, that character has a journey. I mean, that's your story. It's very flighty. You can go anywhere you want to with it. But also, Tree of Life, in its very nature, is about the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's what it is, of existence, of a life.
Right.
It's in its very nature. It follows that.
But does it ever seem self-indulgent to you guys sometimes when you see a director doing a film like this where it comes off like,
That's
and that's
the danger.
Good and bad, I think. I mean, all films, books, music have to be somewhat self-indulgent or else they wouldn't work, I think. I mean...
I think so, too. First of all, there's an aspect of great filmmakers who... There has to be ego there. There's
mm-hmm.
ego in being a filmmaker to begin with. You're expecting people to sit down and pay money to see what the story that you have to tell. And, you have to think that it's worth telling and that you're the guy that's perfect to tell it.
Right.
But there's also, in terms of the indulgence thing, I mean, sometimes it can definitely fall into that category. It feels like you're watching someone masturbate, and that's, like, not enough to maintain an interest in a two-hour film. There has to be some kind of genuine sense of sharing, just something genuine that they're relaying to the viewer that's worthwhile, that you can get something out of. I thought that was Tree of Life, and many people thought it was Malick, you know, jerking it for 2 hours.
You could say that, but that is what, to a lesser extent, what you can say about Malick. But there's so much beauty in the film, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can easily dismiss it. If you really care about storytelling, not movies, but if you care just about storytelling, there's something there. He has taken on a very ambitious, beyond ambitious almost, way to tell a story that encompasses a lot of things. And regardless of whether you think he succeeds or fails, you have to give it an A for effort. And it's a fascinating movie. There are just parts of the movie. I don't think it works all the time, but the parts that do work are very powerful. There's an emotional catharsis towards the end of the film that is ungodly.
I think
almost to say he's jerking it.
Well, I think so because he's clearly searching. I mean, I don't watch Tree of Life and think this director is trying to teach me something. I see a director on a search to get at something.
Mm-hmm.
I think the great directors do that. So I find that that's a very genuine place to come at.
Right.
From an artist's point of view.
But isn't it good, though, that someone like Malick, who, or any director, that at this, we would hope that all the directors that we truly admire, the young ones, if they are still doing this many years from now, they will. I don't see it, any artist, really, as they grow, are looking for these answers, because I don't care who you are. There's no concrete, complete answer to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's wonderful that someone like Malick, I think it's the trailer for the De Palma film alone is something you're just like, wow, he's still at this 40 years mm-hmm. later, and you're just like, wow.
At least they're trying, because we see so often now, I know with Jerry, that they're a lot like me. We're at the movies every weekend, seeing movies, and we can see the same movie every single weekend, just with different actors.
Oh, God, I wish that wasn't. I was doing something else some weekends, I'll tell you that.
So it's so great to see someone like a Malick or a De Palma that's actually trying to do something different. And like you said, maybe he's, succeeding, maybe he's failing, but at least he's trying. And
yeah.
I'd rather see someone that is trying and fails, other than someone who's just doing the same thing and succeeding.
Well, that's a great point. And a failed Malick movie is still infinitely more interesting than most of the blockbusters out there.
Most of the blockbusters are even. I don't know about you, but the last couple of weeks, the last two weekends, you had The Apparition last week and The Possession this weekend. I'm like, I would not. Maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, I wouldn't go on to see those. But I was just like, really? I can stay at home and read a newspaper and get more, or read a book or go online. They're movies that don't do anything for me. I know
they don't
Possession,
nourish you. Yeah.
Yeah, but The Possession, it's the Jewish exorcist. I'm like, really? Really? Do I at least get free bagels when I go see the movie? Are they going to give me bagels and lox when I go see it? No, so the hell with it.
Yeah. That did well this weekend.
It did. No, it did very well. So, we'll have a whole bunch of people going back to Madonna's Kabbalah classes or whatever. So,
Can't wait for The Possession 2.
I know.
Yeah,
I'm
right up there.
What
is that movie that really, The Devil Inside, that out of nowhere, that January movie, that just performed like huge numbers, and it was like the worst reviewed movie of the year?
Yeah.
Was that
just,
this
but
year
it's,
or last?
There's people starving. It's really unbelievable because I was looking and I was like, if you obviously, even if something like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy or A Dangerous Method, I'm just thinking of art house movies, even if those were in wide release, I think The Devil Inside would still make those movies.
Oh, yeah.
People aren't going to go see that. People don't want to see Tinker, I was thinking about that because Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was actually already on cable today after 8 months, mind you. I was really shocked by that, but, it's only 8 months window now. I think it's 6 months with other films, but if that says anything about the current state of movies today. But even if the art house movies that we were raving about, or limited release movies we were raving about last December, were all opened on that first weekend of January, Devil's Aside would still do better than all of them combined. It just the way it is. It's just the way the
What's like the step down from broadcasting on TV? like having a mime like perform it on the streets. In just 10 short months, I was seeing a mime perform Tinker Tailor on the street. I mean, that's how quickly that window is now. Yeah, anyway.
But most of these PG-13 horror movies, I mean, that, those are the people that go out to see the movies. It's all teenagers and kids who, you know, have their cell phones and 10 bucks for mom, and they go to the cinema and they see these movies like, you know, Possession and Devil Inside, because it's, you know, they're looking for a cheap, you know, thrill or a cheap scare. So, I mean, I think all the art house movies, those kind of people are waiting for it on DVD.
Yeah.
And then really get to go into the theater to see it.
That's true. And, but there is something, there is one silver lining to this, though. At least people are still going out to the movies. It is still, it may not be the best of what's out there, but they are still going. That's the only silver lining I can see. I just don't see the appeal, especially in some of these movies where you see, it seems like they show you everything in a trailer. You're like, why would I go see it? You showed me the gotcha moments. You know, it seems like. I noticed in these trailers that are at least like 2 minutes long. It's like, wow, okay.
Yeah, but outside of To the Wonder, we had the Master screen there.
Is this the front runner, you think, so far?
I don't know. I think they both played in... I don't know if the Master's in competition. I know To the Wonder is.
Right, but I mean just for the Oscar season, though.
Well, no. I think that, well, yeah, I do think that it's a major Oscar player. But the Oscar buzz actually got started at Telluride with Argo, with Ben Affleck's film Argo. And that comes out next
October.
Month, too. Yeah.
I've always been a big fan of Ben Affleck as a director. From The Town and Gone Baby Gone, I think he's a very underrated director. I mean, all the films I've seen of him have always been really well-made, well-crafted, and I think he's a really underrated director.
Oh, he is. I think he's getting the respect he deserves, but I think it starts with the movie, I was thinking about this earlier, where he plays is it Hollywood Land, where he plays George Reeves?
Yes.
I think that's the major turning point.
I think
for
it is
him
too.
As an actor, and you know, I think he identified very strongly with George Reeves, and I think that's the major turning point. I'm not saying what he did before was bad. I actually think there was a lot of great work before that, but I think it's an Angelina Jolie kind of thing, where your celebrity overshadows your creative output, which is never good for any artist.
And I think you're absolutely right. He did realize that, and Hollywood Land did seem like a turning point for him, where he said, okay, I'm going to take control of this now because I have a vision of what I want my career to be, and I'm not going to make that a reality by picking up every paycheck movie that comes over to me. You know, but Argo's actually, I mean, he said, he looked at the material and he thought, you know, I don't want to be known as just the director that can do Boston. So this is an international story. It has many colors. Apparently, it starts off very, very dramatic, and then it goes into very comical when they move this movie crew to Iran, a kind of a covert operation to free hostages.
Right.
And then they say that the ending is incredibly intense. I read a review of it that said the climax of this is very, very tense. So, I mean, that in itself, all those different colors that he's painting with, he's broadening his scope, you know, what he's capable of.
Actions of Iran have shocked the civilized world.
Go, let's go, let's go!
Get everything!
Our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
If we're going to go, then we need to go now.
What happened?
Six of the hostages went out a back exit.
Where are they?
The Canadian ambassador's house.
We've got Revolutionary Guards going door to door.
These people die. They die badly.
White House?
Who wants the six of them out?
What we lack for this are bicycles.
Deliver the six bikes, provide them with maps.
Or you could just send in training wheels and meet them at the border with Gatorade.
It's gonna take a miracle to get them out.
Hi, man. What are we watching?
I got an idea.
They're a Canadian film crew for a science fiction movie.
I fly into Tehran. We all fly out together as a film crew.
I need you to help me make a fake movie.
So you want to come to Hollywood and act like a big shot without actually doing anything?
Yeah.
You'll fit right in.
You need a script?
Argo. Science, fantasy, adventure.
Moonscape, Mars, desert.
You need an exotic location to shoot.
You need a producer.
If I'm doing a fake movie, it's going to be a fake hit.
You don't have a better bad idea than this?
This is the best bad idea we have, sir.
I'm so curious. I think it's just such a... It's just the trailer alone. You're just like, wow, this is a really... I would definitely put down a lot of money to see this. It's just a fascinating story to watch unwind. I mean...
Mm-hmm. Has the film gotten any Oscar buzz so far?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I they're talking about Affleck. I'm sure they're talking about some supporting stuff in it, too. I mean, mm-hmm. He's got a great supporting cast.
You think Bryan Cranston will get his supporting?
You know, it's about time Bryan Cranston does some good film work. Because
I know. It does seem like he doesn't. You know, for all the things that Breaking Bad has done for him, his film work, on the other hand, it leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah. I mean, he's in popular movies, but he's... I actually thought, and I did like Drive, obviously.
Yeah, no, Drive was awesome. I mean,
I actually thought he knew what he was doing in Drive. I thought, if this is a shiny new version of a retro film noir,
mm-hmm.
I thought Cranston's playing a great noir character.
Right.
Yeah, I like his character in that and what he did with it. But Rock of Ages, and, I mean, he hasn't done stuff that is worthy of him.
He's in Larry Crown, too.
Well, you
yeah.
know, Larry Crown yeah. is something that we'd all like to forget. I'm sure Tom
not
Hanks.
Worthy of anyone in that.
Yeah, what did it say, though? That, you know, it's really interesting. I like that thing you do. I thought that was good for its time. But this, what was it about Larry Crown?
I don't know. Larry Crown should have been called That Thing You Do.
I kind of see yeah. what he was doing with the film Larry Crown. He was sort of trying to comment on the current employment situation and, you know, how people have to... I guess go back to college now. So kind of see how he was doing with it. But from the title alone, it's like, I think it was just, you know, bad title and very, I mean, I liked it, but I could see why he wouldn't have, like, long staying power.
But here's the thing, Tony, what you say, everything, I agree with everything you just said.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to go, unfortunately, no one wants to go see a movie about that. No
yeah.
one,
yeah.
I mean, I know you're not crazy about it, but the Will Ferrell movie that came out a couple months before that.
The campaign?
Where he lost his job, and you know that's it's an interesting vehicle for Will Ferrell, but no one wants to go see that. No one, you know, people are just like, yeah, whatever. That's
mm-hmm.
a sad thing. No one, it's there are interesting things to be said about those movies, and I was thinking about that while watching Larry Crown. I'm like, wow, this is like the Will Ferrell movie, and you know, people just, you know, they don't want to. That's the interesting thing. You want to make these intelligent. Or somewhat intelligent, or somewhat interesting, serious movies, while the actual events are going on. But no one wants to pluck down $10 to see. Hey, I live this. I don't need to pay money.
Right. I understand.
Yeah, but even so, with Larry Crown, Larry Crown's interesting in a couple of ways. First of all, it shows that no matter how big the wattage of stars you have in your movie,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't ensure anything. I mean, it further speaks to the idea that. Stars are really not a guaranteed currency anymore in movies. Secondly, it felt antiquated. I mean, it felt like something you would have seen in the 90s,
and not in a good way.
Good
point.
And also, maybe in the middle of a depression, when people are seriously hurting and out of work and blah, 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 and I know the thought behind it was, you know, to inspire people to give them a good time and maybe give them hope that there is hope, further your education and blah, 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 and invest in yourself and that kind of thing. But when that lesson is being brought down to you by some of the wealthiest people in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's
you know,
a huge problem. That's a very big problem now.
It feels a bit insincere.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, you're absolutely right.
I'm also, a lot of Hollywood moviegoers are also sort of cynical, too, and I think they don't really want a simple problem like that sort of wrapped up in a 90-minute movie because, you know, not everybody can, you know, go back to school or afford it. And I think maybe on the film terms of the law, they've been a little too sweet and
mm-hmm.
people are far more cynical nowadays about this sort of situation.
You could have gotten away with that in the 30s. You could have definitely gotten away, but you can't get away with this now when everyone knows that, you know, Tom Hanks or Will Ferrell, well, they had a couple $1 million at their, you know, disposal. And even if this movie doesn't do well, you know, it's interesting. Even if these movies did not, they're not going to lose their house.
right.
or their house is. And I don't mean to be sound like that, but it's true that nothing's going to happen to them.
Well, yeah, and Larry Crown isn't really about the unemployment issue.
I think the Will Ferrell movie is somewhat more about that, but not directly. But
Larry Crown is a romantic comedy that exists.
Everything Must Go.
Yeah.
That's what
Everything
Will
Must
Ferrell
Go.
Yeah.
I liked it. It was a good.
It was a good movie. It's just that we've talked about this before on the show, and I know we've talked about this too, Tony, when you've been on. It's hard to sell that kind of stuff now. People just. They do want to see, hey, let's watch the vampires have sex. You know, basically, that's what people want.
Right.
You can't blame them. You can't blame them for wanting that kind of escapist entertainment because, at first and foremost, that's what movies are. I can't really blame someone. They want to go see the shoot 'em up or the silly comedy or something. It's hard to get an idea as a movie or a serious movie about the current times we live in out there.
Well, and actually, if Hanks and Roberts start as vampires that want to have sex, I would buy a ticket to that.
I think everyone would.
as it is, I did not buy a ticket to Larry Crown.
No.
So, also at Telluride, which every time I say Telluride, I want to finish it up with to pick you up at 6. But it's actually so, Telluride, they premiered the Bill Murray as FDR movie, Hudson on the Park. Is that what
is it Hyde Park on the Hudson? Or
yeah, that's exactly what it is. Thank you.
Okay.
They love Bill Murray in it, and they say, yes, he is an awards contender, that he's great in the film. And it's a pleasant little film, they say.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great trailer. I'm looking forward to seeing it. The release date is December 7th is interesting, but...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's...
Oh, that is neat.
Yeah. But I think it's a good. I think it's a great. So we have an FDR movie and we have a Lincoln movie in the span of a month. Interesting.
And then we've had two Lincoln movies this year.
Yeah, but this is not the real. This is not factual. I mean, the Vampire Hunter movie is factual. This isn't factual, right?
Yeah. This is bullshit. He's not hunting vampires.
He never did these things.
Lincoln was president? What?
Wait, what are you doing? We're the vampire!
Spike Lee's Michael Jackson documentary, Bad 25, premiered.
Wow.
And they say it's great. Like, I read a couple of reviews of it, and they say this is just a great, exhilarating documentary that really takes you inside the process of the making of the album and the aftermath of it, and in a very special way. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's going to be aired on Showtime. I think Showtime picked it up.
Oh, okay. No, that's cool. I saw Red Hook Summer last week.
Oh, did you?
And I liked it. I thought it was actually very well done. It was not, because I was like, do I really want to sit through this? And I was like, okay, no, because I like Spike Lee, but I've heard nothing good about it. I have not read a good review of the film, of the few reviews I've read, none of them. And I actually thought it was very well done. Very well done.
Did the third act turn feel like it belonged in a different movie?
That's going to be the thing that they're about, as far as this movie is concerned, that the people will be debating for a long time, because he does you're just like, wow, you want to bring this into it? And you could say it derails the movie. But then for certain plot points that you've heard throughout the movie, it makes sense. It makes sense that this is what happens. But at first, you're just like, really, Spike, you went here?
Yeah.
And you're just like, you're flabbergasted. Because, I'm not going to say what it is. Because it's a limited release movie, and I want people that if I told what the movie, what it was, it would derail, I think, the experience for anyone who wants to see it.
Right.
But you are shocked in a good and bad way. You're just like, wow, that you wanted to bring this in here. Because in one sense, it takes it up to a whole nother level. But at the same time, it also brings the film down a couple of notches, too. But it's a fascinating movie, though. And it does show someone who, really, said many times in the show, is a fascinating director.
Well, it's not unlike him.
No, it's not.
To switch tonalities in a single movie, and you know, even with a setup of a movie like She Hate Me, I remember the part. You know, it seemed like all these kind of different elements that did not belong together, and he crammed them into one movie under one story.
But you know who's in the movie, though? Do you know who's in the movie? I did not know this.
Who's in the movie?
Mookie.
Well, yeah.
I did not know. I know I'd probably read that somewhere. I was like, oh, cool, Mookie's in this. Awesome. So, yeah,
that was like, that really got at the tag of the unofficial sequel to Do the Right Thing, since Lee's
character. And that's the only way it has. Only, like, we're talking 5 minutes at the most there.
Yeah, it's just a return to that neighborhood for him.
Action!
All right, I'm keep it hunting for you. Some real talk. People laugh at me. They laugh, and that's okay. But you know what? I got something a lot of Americans don't have. A J-O-B. People out of work, hurting, no job, losing their homes, all types of crazy stuff. I've been delivering pieces of sales for over 20 years, but you know what? Delivering all those pieces, the extra cheese too, put my son, Hector, through college. So I really got no complaints. Didn't work out between me and Tina, but that's all right. And I'm just grateful I still have my job. My pizza's never cold.
Did you see the interview with Spike Lee that was conducted on Movie City News?
No. What was that? Like, what was?
Do you ever watch those interviews, David Poland's interviews on there?
I know who David Poland is, but I never watch his things. I know Glenn Kenny has a lot of issues with David Poland, I think, but...
Yeah. Well, David Poland, he has a series on there called DP30. It sounds like something pornographic, but it actually
stands for...
It does.
That's the first deal. I think of DP, I think of something completely different.
I'm going to give you a DP30. Or, you know, when you get your oil change. Do you watch the DP30 synthetic? No, but it stands for David Poland 30, because each segment is like 30-minute video interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are very good. Some of them, the manner in which he interviews people is so... like lackadaisical, and the questions are not specific in the least. It really sometimes feels like he's pulling it out of his butt, and not in a, which I do, but I try to be articulate when I do it, and a lot of times he doesn't come across as very eloquent when he does it. But he does get amazing people at times, and some of his interviews are very good. But the Spike Lee one he did for Red Hook Summer, that is one of the most combative things I've ever seen in my life in terms of an interview.
Wow, what happened?
Well, because he'll ask flighty questions like, and that third act twist, was that intentional? Which I know what he's saying. I can understand where he's saying, did you set out in the beginning of the project to address this issue that pops up in the third act?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a question of getting to that point and making that leap believable. That would have been the articulate way to ask that question. But the way he asked it, it seemed like, you know, was that an accident that happened? And Spike Lee got so pissed. He was like, I don't know what the F you're talking about, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course it was intentional. We made this movie. Everything about it was intentional. Everything was written. You know, we didn't just accidentally shoot something. And the whole interview is essentially like that.
Wow, okay.
It's very, very testy. Yeah, it's great. It's great to watch.
I'll have to check that out, okay.
You know what else is great to watch? Have you guys seen, there's a guy on YouTube that imitates Ian McKellen?
No, I've not seen that. No.
I found this the other day, and I just had to play a little clip of it. This is some guy just sitting at his house in front of his video camera, webcam, whatever it is, imitating Ian McKellen singing Baby Got Back.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
I'm sold already.
Here he is. This is a great impression. Here he is.
I like big butts, and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny that when a girl walks in with an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung. What a pull-up tough, because you notice that butt was stuffed deep in the jeans she was wearing. I'm hooked, and I can't stop staring. Yo, baby, I want to get with ya and take your picture. My homeboys tried to warn me, but that butt you got makes me so horny.
That was brilliant, man. That was beyond brilliant.
That was so good. So speaking of Ian McKellen, they came out with a release date for The Hobbit 3 for 2000.
And what is the title of The Hobbit 3?
Right now it's The Hobbit 3.
That's so original. I just can't wait to see that.
Yeah. But it comes out in 2014. But did they announce the release date for the second one? Or did they just...
It's 2014, December of 2014, or 2013, I mean, I'm sorry. So it's like a year from the release date of the one that comes out this year, so...
Are people looking forward to any of these? I can't get a sense of it.
You know what? I really don't care. And I love the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but I got to be honest with you. I'm going to see Jack Reacher.
Uh-huh.
Okay? If that says anything. I would like to have seen Del Toro take a stab at this.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't get a sense that... I certainly didn't know that the first Lord of the Rings trilogy would be as globally popular as it was. I mean, I saw that it was a gamble. I thought that it would be moderately successful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The phenomenon that it was, I couldn't have predicted that. But on the heels of that, I mean, I see the press like doing articles on The Hobbit, but I don't sense an excitement among bloggers or regular people that I see writing about movies online. Or, you know,
it's been so long. I think some of the interest and the excitement has kind of, you know, weighed down because it's taken so long for the film to finally be released.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, I think that. I also think you're only talking now. It doesn't seem that long. It's been nine years since The Return of the King, and it doesn't seem long at all, but I could see one movie. I might have been given two, but three, I think you're just asking for trouble. And what's really interesting is not that this matters one way or the other, but you know, the Tolkien estate's not crazy about his films. I read that a couple months ago. I thought that was interesting.
Well, The Hobbit, you said The Hobbit releases the same day as the Tom Cruise movie, Reacher.
No, but around that, I mean, the December, as we know, is going to be a madhouse.
Yeah. Well, both of those movies are about short people. So,
okay, you said it, not me. Okay. but look, The Hobbit is a very well-regarded, well-loved book. I mean, but... And they wanted to. I mean, it just seems like after the fact, the prequel, since it is a prequel, regardless, and prequels are not that interesting, as we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
We know. I mean, you know, we always said, "Oh, it would be the how." We know what happens in Star Wars, but it'd be the how. Well, the problem was the how wasn't really that interesting, except towards the very, very end. And you know, in here, it's like we know. I mean, everyone's read The Hobbit, or who cares about it has read it, and that's millions of people, but do we need it committed to film? Can't Peter Jackson do something else?
Mm.
But obviously he can't, so he's going to be, you know, this is what he's going to be associated with. The Tolkien. That's his legacy.
I really couldn't care less. I still haven't seen Two Towers or Return of the King. I mean,
haven't? Okay,
no,
wow. Okay. But you're honest about that. Good for you.
It's not my thing. You know?
I respect that. You know how much I respect that.
I mean, I can admire the artistry of the production and that kind of thing, and I don't care about fairies and sorcery and knights and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. Fantasy and that kind of thing. I have my own fantasies to deal with.
I understand that. No, I admire that. I respect that greatly. I don't know. Can I be honest? I don't know what to make of it, because ever since this thing came out a couple months ago about the frame rate, I'm like, really? We're going to talk about the why don't let's focus on the content of the movie before we get worked up about the frame rate issue.
Yeah. It's like everybody talking about Eastwood instead of Romney. It's kind of I feel like it derailed interest in the movie, the whole frame rate thing.
Yeah.
Does this movie just exist to introduce a new frame rate? Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Totally.
And plus, no one's really going to be able to see the 24 frames per second. I mean,
not around
like
here, they're not.
Yeah, it seems like a moot point because very few people are going to be able to appreciate it to begin with. Also in Venice, they honored Cimino for Heaven's Gate.
Mm-hmm.
They rescreened it. He got a standing ovation. He walked out on stage looking like an emaciated Joan Collins. And he will be in New York as well, actually with the film. So he's traveling with it.
Good for him. Now that I find fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I bought I just watched a Blu-ray this morning of a Nicholas Ray movie that I hadn't seen before.
Which one?
Bigger Than Life.
Oh, okay. Wow. And you own that. Cool.
Yeah, and I bought it last week, and I bought two. I bought The Leopard, and I bought Bigger Than Life, because I said
cool,
I need to see these two. But I was crazy about Bigger Than Life. I mean, this is made in something like 1956.
Mm-hmm.
Nicholas Ray, who most people know as the director of Rebel Without a Cause, or that's the movie that most people know of his. But there's James Mason plays this high school professor or the school professor. And, you know, he's a middle-class suburban American family of a wife and a son. And he has this medical condition. He gets prescribed cortisone, and he becomes an addict. And it changes his personality. So much so that he goes from being a kind of verbally abusive to his wife to actually preparing to kill his son by the end of the movie. I mean, it's like this ever-increasing hysteria that he experiences during the course of the movie. But what I love about it is how it's filled to the brim with subtext, where it's not actually about a drug addict and the impact that has on a suburban family in the 50s. It's about kind of rebelling against the complacency of suburban life. And this is pre-60s, you know,
right.
when a lot of the culture actually did that. And there's so many kind of subtle subtext in the movie that speaks to this. It's just filled with it, even down to Walter Matthau plays his best friend in the movie and work colleague. And there's the slightest indication that Walter Matthau could be gay, which is yet another indication of an idealized American lifestyle that doesn't allow you the freedom of being who you want to be, you know. I thought it was just a great, great movie, way ahead of its time.
Hello, I'm James Mason. I want to interest you in a new film that we've just finished at 20th Century Fox. Since this was my first assignment as a producer at a major studio, I made sure that the story chosen contained all the ingredients that I like to find when I'm a member of the audience. I want excitement and entertainment in its broadest sense, but I also insist that the human issues involved are of the sort that might reasonably crop up in the everyday lives of all of us. Our story is based on just such an issue. It's about a drug which, properly used, can be a lifesaver, but improperly used can be a life destroyer. Hardly a day goes by without new and shocking revelations in the nation's press about these drugs. And now here it is, out in the open at last. A story of a handful of hope that became a fistful of hell.
High melodrama, but look underneath the surface. I mean, first of all, it goes really far for its time. I mean, the hysteria in the movie, I mean, it's kind of a brave movie. It's tacked on with a kind of a pat ending, which I can imagine the studio forcing upon him. But other than that, it's just a great, great movie. And James Mason, I mean, something has to be said about James Mason. I go from Bigger Than Life, and then a few years later doing Lolita. I mean, he did some daring, brave,
dangerous
stuff. He's good. Let's hear James Mason singing Baby Got Back. That's what I want. And I saw a great movie called Brooklyn Brothers Beat the Best last night. It's an independent film that's going to be released in limited a couple of weeks from now. It's been playing festivals.
Cool.
And if you get it, anyone gets an opportunity to see that movie, do it. It is the most charming, rousing, feel-good movie that I've seen in a long time. Genuinely funny. It's very, 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 very good. So outside of that, other movie news, Beverly Hills Cop, Eddie Murphy wants to turn it into a TV series. Do we think that's a good idea?
It can't hurt. I mean, is he going to be in it or no?
No. I don't think so. He wants to produce it. He wants the further adventures of Axel Foley on weekly television.
Well, who would you get to play Axel Foley?
I don't know.
I mean, how much life would a show like that have, though? I just can't picture a 20 or 22 episode season of a show like that. Because they've already done the film. It's like, how much more can they squeeze out of that? And to me, it seems like they're trying to sell it on the name and hope that people will tune in, but I could see that getting old very quickly after a certain number of episodes, because, I mean, how many adventures can they get into week to week?
I see that part very, very vividly, too, like what you just said. But there's something that Aaron said in one of our past shows. He said the mistake of Beverly Hills Cop 2 was that it kind of totally discarded what made the first one so good, which was the fish-out-of-water element. And there comes a time when you can't be a fish out of water anymore, especially in a series that runs 22 episodes a season or whatever it might be. After a while, you become kind of acclimated to your surroundings and you're no longer a fish out of water. You're kind of accepting of your surroundings.
Well,
but
how many films that have returned into shows have really been successful? The only one I could really think of recently is Friday Night Lights. Like, you think of The Firm, and that didn't do well. There hasn't been too many movies turned into shows that have really been successful.
Well, the most successful would be MASH, wouldn't it? Recently. No, I mean, and even the things I'm thinking about that I grew up with, like, there was a Fast Times at Ridgemont High that was short-lived, and Private Benjamin did okay, but for the most part, it's really not a great genre. It doesn't work for the most part.
I think if they're based off books, they can be successful, because a lot of times when you have a book like Friday Night Lights, which is turned into a movie and then a TV show, there's so much material there and so much rich material to kind of, flesh out over the course of a couple of seasons. But, something like Beverly Hills Cop, yes, I think Jamie's right about the fish out of water sequence. It's like, how many times can that happen over a course of like 25-week season before it gets very old in a hurry?
Well, and even being based on a book doesn't guarantee anything, because Eastwick flopped after like two shows. They pulled the Witches of Eastwick show off the air last year, or whenever that was. It was recently. So I think it's a good idea only for this reason. What are the number one shows on TV week after week? They're all cop, investigative
stuff.
Right,
yeah.
CSI. Just call it CSI Beverly Hills.
If they play it like that,
But doesn't one of the CSIs actually... No, they don't have a CSI Beverly Hills.
Well, why don't they just use CSI Beverly Hills?
That's what they should recall it, and that'll confirm success for them. Anyway, Michael Keaton's in the RoboCop remake. Does the RoboCop remake raise expectations now in your mind when Michael Keaton joins the cast?
I just feel just so old. I'm waiting to get my ARP membership at this point when I hear things like that. Who's directing it now? Who's
I'm Jose Padilla.
Oh, and what did he do?
Elite Squad.
Oh, that? Oh my God. Okay, wow. He's doing... Really? We couldn't get... Why isn't Aronofsky doing this?
I don't know. And apparently, it's a hellish development. Like, they're having a hell of a time making a script that anybody agrees with. And yet, they've assembled a great group of actors. I mean, as good as you could possibly imagine in a RoboCop movie. Gary Oldman, Samuel Jackson.
Oh, no, it's a great cast.
Michael Keaton, Jackie Earl Haley. So, I mean, it's a sledgehammer cast for something that, could be very, very silly. But
my thing is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
I know that sounds old school and everything, but I really don't. The sequels, none of the sequels were good. The TV series wasn't good. It's the original thing. Verhoeven made it. It was a satire. It was perfect.
And what the hell is up with you, Laurie, turning down, agreeing to do these roles and then turning them down? Apparently he has a big history of doing that. Because the only reason why Michael Keaton stepped in is because you, Laurie, backed out. And the only reason why Frank Langella did Perry White in Bryan Singer's Superman movie was because Hugh Laurie backed out. I keep hearing from these movies that
and
Hugh Laurie...
And Frank Langella was great as Perry. I thought he was one of the highlights of that film, actually. So
yeah, and they called him like a couple of days before they needed him. Because the dude backed out like last minute. And what is up with him?
Wasn't he in 100... Don't laugh at me, but wasn't he in 101 Dalmatians?
He could have been. What, did he play one of the dogs? Or
no, he played one of the thieves or one of the bad guys, I think, but yeah.
What, did he play the dog house in that?
Yeah, the dog house, yes, exactly.
It was Jennifer Aniston and Hugh Laurie as the dogs in the film, right?
Yes. So are you good? Did you see The Phantom Menace in 3D when it came out in theaters, Jerry?
Oh, God, come on. I know people that did, and people ask me, well, why aren't you going to see it? I'm like, really? You would have to edit 90 minutes out of the movie to make it watchable.
Well, episodes 2 and 3 are coming out in September and October in 2013. They're just a month apart.
Yeah, so. I like the third one a lot, but it doesn't need to be in 3D. How is it going to – I mean, none of these things have to be in 3D.
No. Well, they got gradually better. But still, that
it's
that
a third one. A second one, that's debatable. I mean, that's like saying, yes, I still need a lot of effects on Zoroff to sit through it. But, you know, I think what we're witnessing here with Lucas is, and you could say the same thing about this Raiders of the Lost Ark and IMAX. I don't think I'm sure it will be fun to see it in IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need that, though.
No, we don't need any of it. But I will go see Raiders on IMAX. I'm really looking forward to that. And actually, I want to see Temple of Doom on the big screen again, too.
Oh, I would welcome any of them. Well, except Skull, I would welcome on the big screen again. But
yeah.
But I don't – in 3D, any of the Star Wars movies, I don't – it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a movie in 3D yesterday at my niece's urging, Paranorman.
Uh-huh.
And it's a good movie, but there was no reason to see that in 3D. No, I mean, just none. But she was like, oh, you'll really like this, Uncle Jerry. I went to go see it. It was fun, but, I mean, I didn't need to see it in 3D.
Right.
And I have to say the same thing. Nothing short of getting rid of Jake Lloyd and I would say, how long is The Phantom Menace? At least 2.5 hours. Getting rid of 2 hours and 5 minutes. So that leaves the pod race. It doesn't really matter. I mean,
yeah. Show me the pod race in 3D.
Show me the pod race. It doesn't even be in 3D. It can be just in George Lucas's house.
And just show it to me as like an example of how good 3D television is while I'm sitting in the lobby of Best Buy.
Exactly.
You know? So they are remaking. This is the latest remake news. So we have something new every week. The remaking Scarface, the Pacino De Palma version of Scarface, which in itself was a remake, obviously. And Bregman's the one behind it. You know, the producer, Martin Bregman, he was trying to get a Son of Tony or some kind of sequel to Scarface off the ground for a while, and now it's happening. And Rihanna has thrown her hat in the ring. She desperately wants to play Elvira Hancock. And I think if they do a sequel to Scarface, a remake, rather, that they will play up the hip hop angle.
Oh yeah, I don't see how you could not do
that.
I think
they'll play directly to that demographic. Actually.
Oh, and it's smart. I mean, that movie will clean up.
Who would you get to direct it though?
Anton Fuqua.
That's a great choice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an awesome choice. I would think that movie would do very well right now.
Yeah. I don't know. Bring back Giorgio Moroder. You need his...
Well, that score is so beautiful. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite parts of the movie, actually. I mean...
It's like Giorgio Moroder in that movie is like Tangerine Dream on cocaine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly.
It's very good.
Why don't you try sticking your head up your ass? See if it fits.
I wanted to ask you guys, it's September right now, so I want to know what has been, I don't know, about the Venice Film Festival and all the big, I guess, Oscar films are going to be coming out for the rest of the year. So far in the year, what films have you guys really responded to and liked so far up until September 2nd?
Like, what would be in your year-end list? Anything
yeah,
good?
So far.
Moonrise Kingdom and Beasts of the Southern Wild, I would definitely put in there. I would put The Dark Knight Rises and Savages and even, to a lesser extent, Spider-Man and Prometheus. And I've seen a lot of other movies. I mean, The Grey, I liked a lot. And The Hunger Games, I liked a lot. But The Raid, Redemption, I liked a lot, too. But, I mean, it's hard to say because it's just some films are such a blur sometimes, you know. But those are the ones that stand out. I mean, I've seen a lot of interesting films. I don't know. I mean, I know Prometheus is like the movie that everyone hates. They were looking forward to, but when it opened, everyone hated. But I enjoyed it immensely.
I would definitely have The Dark Knight Rises and Savages would be on my list currently. Even though I would expect Savages might drop off after.
I think Savages might. I mean, I would definitely. It's on my list too, but it definitely would. I would think drop off eventually. There have been a lot of high-profile disappointments, Tony.
Yeah, there have been high-profile disappointments, and I'm wondering what would be a high-profile disappointment for the fall, because from this point on, from The Master on, there are a lot of movies I'm looking forward to, whereas the first part of the year there were very few. I mean, one right
very
after another
few.
In the fall.
Very few. I mean, absolutely.
What would be the disappointment? But, you know,
I can tell you Life of Pi and On the Road are the ones that come to mind that might be disappointments. God, Django Unchained. Django Unchained could be a disappointment.
It could be. It could be. But I'm thinking about Lincoln. I mean, will Lincoln?
Well, Lincoln could be huge. It could be awful. It's interesting. You have the other film that could be a huge disappointment is the Catherine Bigelow movie. There are a couple. I think the thing that Cloud Atlas is something that has the potential to be just I think Cloud Atlas is the kind of movie that can it's probably going to open wide, if I'm not mistaken, and it will die and the next will be gone from theaters in 2 weeks.
And then I think years from now a cult will form around it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think the most interesting film, one of the most interesting films that's going to come out this fall, more so than The Bond or the Tarantino movie, than one of the films I'm really looking forward to, even more than The Master, is Killing Them Softly.
Oh, gosh, that looks great.
It looks
awesome. Cannot wait. I cannot wait.
I really cannot wait. It is like the American equivalent cast to Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, you know? I mean,
apparently that movie is about capitalism. Like that movie is the capitalism movie, hidden as a hitman gangster movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You ever killed anyone?
No.
You can get touchy-feely.
Emotional, not fun. A lot of fuss. They cry, they plead, they beg, they piss themselves, they call for their mothers. It's embarrassing. I like to kill them softly. From a distance. Not close enough for feelings. Don't like feelings. Don't want to think about them. We need Mickey. What's the problem?
Mickey's expensive.
Not at the moment.
You get him for 10?
15.
You do it for 15?
15, asshole. I think in this economy, a quick 15 for 2 days' work would sound pretty good to Mickey. We'll sell him a party. Fly in, whack a guy, fly out. Quick 15.
Fly coach.
How do you guys see the Judd Apatow movie, This Is 40 playing? Do you think that one is going to do well at the box office and critically?
Oh, I think it has potential to do very well. You need a comedy in there in that season, so I think that may... I mean, you have a lot of big films opening just within that week. Not even that month, just that week.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that could capitalize with the comedy.
Well, it'll be very interesting. What, you know, what does Judd think of that? You know, middle age,
mm-hmm.
and that's a big thing. This is someone who's all of his films and things he's been related to are about grown-ups acting as children or just, you know, man children, as you were. So he's going to really try to make a serious attempt to address what does it mean to be, you know, to enter middle age, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, one of my friends posted something on Facebook that I thought kind of interesting about Paul Rudd, about how it seems like Hollywood has been trying for years and years to make Paul Rudd a movie star, and I don't really think he's, I mean, I think he's a great supporting character, and I think he's very funny, but I still don't think he's leading man material. And it seems like they've been trying hard with films like, you know, Wanderlust, Over My Dead Body, and it seems like they've been trying really hard to make Paul Rudd a movie star, and
mm-hmm.
I think he's great as an ensemble piece, but I don't really get excited for a Paul Rudd movie, and with a Leslie Mann, I'm kind of getting tired of Joan Apatow, I think, shoving her down our throats, because I don't think she's that funny, and I think it's kind of, I guess, selective casting by her being in all of his movies.
Might not have a job otherwise, you know? I mean, as you say,
that's true.
I mean, she was one of the characters, I think the mother in Paranorman. We were, like, watching the credits yesterday, and we're like, that was Leslie Mann? Oh, my God. Okay.
Well, actually, she's required to be in this one, since it follows the characters from Knocked Up.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about, you can say that, you know, who necessarily would have thought Seth Rogen would carry in a movie when Knocked
mm-hmm.
Up came out? I think it's the material, you know, more than anything.
That's a big deal, yeah.
And I remember they spent the longest time trying to make George Clooney a leading man. He would tank after tank after tank, and finally he hit, you know. And now he's one of the biggest leading men that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, I think Paul Rudd, you know, he was good in I Love You, Man, but that was not a big hit. And he was good in, you know, Our Idiot Brother, but that was an ensemble movie, as you pointed out. He's very good in ensemble movies.
Right.
We'll see. I mean, this is an interesting movie because in one sense it seems out of place with all these movies that are coming out at the end of the year. And this seems to be a very, you know, the way it's at least the trailer, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even though it's a comedy, they're trying to give it a very serious presentation.
This sounds horrible, but do you ever wonder what it would be like if you and your wife were separated by something bigger? Like death, like her death?
I have given it a fair amount of thought.
Not in any painful way, but just like a gentle floating off.
It's got to be peaceful. I mean, this is the mother of your children.
And then the new wife would be great.
God, I can't wait to meet my second wife. I hope she likes me better than this one.
I mean, just watching the ad, you know, the Leslie Mann character is like, oh, we have to, you know, we have to do this. We have to spend more time with our children. We have to do this and this. It almost seems like a how-to guide in a movie at times, just watching the trailer.
You mentioned Larry Crown and how people didn't want to see Larry Crown because it was, you know, talking about serious issues. Do you think that people are going to want to see a movie about hitting 40 and kind of everything going downhill in a way?
I'll be 42. I'll be 42 when the movie comes out. I want to just rather just go, just get tanked before going to see the movie. Then I'll watch it. But I mean, I don't know. I don't. It's a good, Tony. That's a very good question. I mean, there will be people that want to see it. My generation will definitely want to see it.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, the rule of thumb is that the 18 to 25s are the ones that drive the box office anyway.
Yeah.
This is 40 is not selling the same crowd as Knocked Up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very good point you bring up, because 40 is considered, like, ancient. I mean, 40, regardless of what generation or what year we're talking to, whenever that demographic is 40, they think, oh, my God, it's the end of your, are you collecting Social Security? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But hey, there is something along those lines, though, when you're in that demographic, that's what they think of. That should not be the prize demographic anymore. That really shouldn't be.
Yeah, I'm curious what the demographic is now, if that's changed or altered at all.
I would think, Jamie, the demographic would be over 50 at this point. If you really want to, if we've learned anything the last year, just from the way people, the trends and everything, and just what we're hearing about the election coming up, I would think 50, 55 and over is what you want to be appealing to.
Look, you talk about a movie, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. That did very well.
Right.
And
I would aim for that demographic.
Yeah. I was reading an article online about how with movies, like you said, about Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, Hope Springs, and even mentioned The Expendables, too, as well, as sort of, you know, aiming to people who want to go to the movies. You know, people, I know a lot of older people who want to go to the movies and they're dying to go to the movies, but something like Ted is not really their style of comedy, where something like, you know, Hope Springs is, you know, more relatable and, you know, more and more comedic. Same with Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Or they can watch The Expendables 2, which sees, you know, action stars that are in their 50s and 60s. So I think that is a forgotten audience that is slowly but surely sort of getting back into Hollywood.
I think so, too. Yeah,
I agree with that. I mean, and Expendables 2 is doing better than the original one.
It could be, yeah. I want to see a trailer for Lincoln. I mean, they came out with a poster. A trailer has to pop up sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see the tone of this movie, like what it looks like. And then I'll kind of solidify in my mind whether to... I don't know.
Are you trying to wrap things up, or can I ask a very important question to our show?
Go ahead.
It is actually a very important question because it regards probably one of the most successful filmmakers of all time.
Okay.
And I do not mean this in a sacrilege way at all, because I actually, as you know, Jamie, I love this director's last film. It was on my top 10 list. But I read comments. I do go online from time to time. I'm not online, thankfully, as much as I used to. But has Steven Spielberg lost some of his mojo?
There was a major backlash against Steven Spielberg. It's been kind of cropping up in the past year and a half, 2 years, I've found, where the critical intelligentsia, whatever that is, they have come up and they have said, you know, all that sentimentalized sensitivity, overblown wonderment. It's so piss poor and so overpraised. It's just a fact. There's nothing truthful about it. That's kind of the writing for a certain Spielberg criticism now, the slant that writing is taking. Now, I don't agree with that, and I think
I don't agree with that at all.
Most daring stuff in his career just in the past decade, 15 years. I mean, you know, Munich is not the work of a man that the master of escapism, you know, which
right.
He is. He is the undisputed master of escapism based on previous movies, not based on Crystal Skull. I think maybe he's lost his feeling for escapism or, you know. I think he wants to go deeper.
Yeah, because I want to bring that up, because I think Crystal Skull and what was the animated movie he made along with War Horse. I can't even remember the goddamn title. I like War Horse, because I think War Horse, it does have some of that sentimentality, but it also deals with very serious things as well. I thought War Horse was very well done. Obviously, I think Munich is excellent. I think War of the Worlds is much better than people give it credit for. I don't think he's lost it. I think with Lincoln... I think there is the thing that I was referring to is, I guess, because it's come out that he is very partisan and he had helped the Obama campaign with something. And I was reading the comments in this one thread, and they really went after him. And I know I shouldn't read the comments. I was addressed about this last week. I shouldn't read the comments, but I did. This was a couple of months ago. And they really went after him. And I was looking at the last couple. So, yeah, Tintin and Crystal Skull. I wouldn't write home that with it, but everything else I can definitely say, yeah, they're really
masterful filmmaker. You know,
yeah.
And Tintin I did not like. The one thing I did like was the visualization. I liked the direction of it. But I think it's just another example in terms of that, the comments that you read of people not being able to separate politics from, you know, creative achievement, which I could give a crap what his politics are.
Right.
If he makes good movies, I'm going to respond to them. But he did have a lull for a little while, but he's changing, I feel. You know, he's not the Spielberg that made E.T. and Close Encounters.
That's not going to come back. I don't think that's ever going to, and nor should it come back in that sense. I mean,
he's
evolving as a filmmaker, and he's, you know, showing different sides of his palette, and he's, you know, trying different things. We didn't want to just see E.T. and Jaws for 30, 40 years out of the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right.
you know, Minority Report and War of the Worlds are two very dark movies.
AI is a dark movie for that matter.
Absolutely.
I do see
Minority Report as kind of a bridging between the exciting escapist fare and the darker stuff that he does.
You're right.
I think he's an interesting filmmaker, and his composition is impeccable. He's still got all the visual gifts that he always had. You can talk about cinemalization and if that's worthy or not, but E.T. is just a positive, life-affirming movie, but at the same time, it's pretty honest about, at that time, the divorced suburban family. I mean, it's not an idealized family. I mean, she's divorced.
Right.
She's grief-stricken about her husband and having to raise her kids alone, and one of her kids has these problems in school, and, you know, she feels kind of overwhelmed. I mean, it's honest about that, I think.
Right.
That's the major thing. I mean, he even when he made Escapist Entertainment, I think he was always honest. I didn't see any dishonesty in his movies, except for the end. You know, I see the ending of War of the Worlds as more dishonest than anything in E.T.
Well, just because their street is intact. I mean, their street has electricity. Wait, I mean, guys, what, the tripod said, hey, we'll leave this street alone? I mean, what the hell? I mean, come on.
Yeah, but that really felt like a descent into hell for that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then the robots are taken down by, you know, a form of a common cold, which is neat. I mean, that's fine.
Well, that's in the original, too, though, in one sense, bacteria. That's not, but
yeah.
I would have actually liked if it ended, and this is a horrible thing to say, this is seriously my mind. I'm a big fan of the movie, but if it had ended where, you know, that scene where they're marching along, before the final confrontation with the tripod, where he says, hey, you know, hey, you can do this, I wouldn't have minded that because you were so beaten down. It makes sense. Okay, you're going to end this on a down note. Okay.
Well, it tied it up with a little neat bow in a way that did feel antithetical to the rest of the movie.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I'll give everyone that.
But you could have done it any other way. I mean, come on. This is a $200 million movie with Tom Cruise. it's like,
and he's great
and the
in
kid
it, by
dies.
The way.
Goodbye, everybody. Yeah.
He's awesome in the movie, by the way. I love his performance in that movie. I mean...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is very good, but you're right. There has been a major cooling off in terms of the overpraise of Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because, you know, so many film goers, when you do something that is successful, they want you to do that over and over and over again. And when you do something that they're not accustomed to, or something that's a little more personal, or something that's a little outside the box, I think they don't know how to handle a filmmaker doing something different, because they're like, oh, you're
right.
Doing this film. If you've made this film before, you want to make this kind of film. So I think a lot of times the general film public wants you to do what you've always been doing, where as a creative artist, you want to expand your horizons and you want to paint with different paintbrushes and you want to show off different sides of your directing talents and, like, you know, animated or, you know, something like War Horse or Munich. You know, he has so many other ideas than what people just want him to do.
And I think, you know, I just rewatched Jaws on the Blu-ray and this gorgeous transfer and restoration of that movie. And, I mean, it's an undeniably solid adventure. I mean, it's something Jack London could have written. You
absolutely,
know, like
that
kind of rousing adventure at sea movie. And it's just, it's expertly done. And it knows what it is. E.T., Close Encounters, they know what they are.
Right.
They're not trying to solve hunger or, you know... They don't have loftier ambitions beyond their opening frame and their ending frame, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he does a certain style of movie better than anyone. And when he ventures off into different territory, it's always interesting to me. You know, sometimes there are mixed results. I mean, Amistad is a bore for me personally, but Munich has really powerful moments in it. Schindler's List is the masterpiece.
Yeah, Schindler's List is the other one that's just like, you know, is a very, you know, one of the darkest films. And Munich is very much so, too. And Saving Private Ryan, for that matter, is a very dark film. They're all three of those are, and Empire of the Sun and The Color Purple, for that matter.
Yeah, and I adore, you know that I adore Empire of the Sun.
It's very important. It's a very important film, and it's really interesting. It didn't get the, I don't think that ever got the praise it deserved when it came out. I think it always got lost in the shuffle because of The Last Emperor. It got lost in that, but it's The Empire of the Sun is a magnificent, just visually, just magnificent movie. But that says a lot right there. That's a different take on World War II than anything I think that we had seen before in a major movie.
Yeah, and it's a perfect bridging of his takes on adolescence. And it, just as Jim in that movie goes from an adolescent to a grown man, just in the course of his time spent on camp, so did Spielberg, I think, as a filmmaker. I see that kind of transition happening with Empire of the Sun. But here's another thing. Here's probably the final word on this. It's something that we expressed with Tony Scott the other week when we did the show on him. It's that intellectual snobism. He's too popular. He's too popular. Escapism cannot be worthy of admiration, you know. Everything's got to be, you know, some kind of auteurist, you know. It has to be art. It has to stink of art for a lot of people to take it seriously.
I think we're all blessed to have these great filmmakers like a Scorsese or a Spielberg or Oliver Stone. There isn't that many great, great directors left. So when I see a Spielberg film, I know that it's going to be very well made, very interesting, and something worth my time. I might not like it, but I know
it's worth watching.
Exactly.
One of my favorite directors are Stanley Kubrick and Brian De Palma. I mean, one of them exercises my mind, and De Palma just gets me kind of intoxicated on the joy of the cinematic. You know, it's pure pleasure, a De Palma film for me. And then I'm challenged in a completely different way and rewarded in a different way by a Kubrick film. So there's room for everything. And by the way, I think there's incredible artistic merit in those earlier escapist Spielberg movies.
Oh, so definitely.
All right. VHS is a horror anthology. It's been a while since we've had one of those, I think. And what makes it particularly special and unique, it features a lineup of some of the most interesting directors working in films today. And we got two of them to talk about the film. It's currently available on demand. It releases in select theaters on October 5th. And two of the directors that we're speaking to tonight, Glenn McQuaid and Joe Swanberg, interesting guys. Glenn McQuaid has a history in the horror genre. Most recently, he directed I Sell the Dead, which I think that we talked about when that came out. And Joe Swanberg is completely foreign to horror movies. He's one of the major players in the mumblecore movement with his Hannah Takes the Stairs and Alexander the Great. I actually really liked Alexander the Great. Was a good film, I thought. But we spoke to both of them. We start out with Glenn McQuaid, and then we move on to Joe Swanberg. And Tony asked them about working in the horror genre, particularly the found footage horror genre, and the collaboration and how that worked with the other directors on the projects.
And the idea is that they have been sent to the house to retrieve one particular videotape that they haven't been told much about. They've just been told they'll know it when they find it.
Which one is it?
I don't know, man.
It was really important for us all to really come up with a good, legitimate reason why everybody's filming themselves. I mean, the only real kind of creative mission of VHS was just, you know, try to do something that we hadn't seen a million times.
You're all going to die up here.
In my segment, it is about a couple that is on a road trip, trying to get some excitement back in their marriage. And while they're staying in their hotel, a strange person knocks on their door.
I enjoy this. You're holding a camera.
And it sort of snowballs out of control from there.
Please don't do this.
What?
I said I didn't want you to record something.
Our focus is to make something about really good, average guys that make the right decision and then get punished for that.
Our segment is about a character named Emily and her boyfriend James, who are in a long-distance relationship,
and it takes place entirely over Skype conversations.
My apartment's haunted.
It's not haunted. I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation.
It's a story about a group of college-age dudes on their final night of spring break who come across a pair of video spyglasses and decide that they want to trick some girls into shooting a porno. And, of course, things go horribly wrong.
What is going on, Blue? What did you see?
I don't know!
Something really cool about how unprecious this movie is, and so when people are clapping and cheering and shouting, it just makes the film more fun to experience. And that was the premiere experience at Sundance. It couldn't have been, like, more raucous.
You're watching this?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We had a guy pass out. I'd like to believe that. It just scared him so much.
Guys, come on!
Besides the realism, how do you explain the appeal of found footage films?
I think audiences are just ready for, or have been ready for, a kind of a spanner thrown into the works for some time now. I think it's kind of given a fresh perspective on horror. And on top of that, I think when you do have to sacrifice some of the more overt fantasy elements of movies, like your soundtrack and so on, and keep everything to a certain extent real, that it adds an extra dimension. I think also just with the popularity of, I guess even a term like home video is antiquated now, but you know, everybody's got a camera on their phones now, and can really relate to being in the situations that a lot of the characters in found footage movies are put into.
And knowing that these films have been done before, what did you do individually on your particular segment to make it unique and stand out for an audience?
Well, I think what VHS does, I think what all of the segments, or most of the segments do in their own right, is to allow some of the fantasy back in. And I think that's a good thing for, I guess, the found footage subgenre, if you will. I think that, by the end of the movie, it clearly is more about escapism than sort of snuff realness and so on. And I think it's healthy to say to people, look, we can have fun with this now. We can, push the boundaries a little bit. Everything doesn't have to be just so real. Let's make it a little bit more about entertainment and so on. You know, I think at the end of the day with found footage, it's the same with any other movie, really. If the stories aren't there and if the characters aren't there, it's going to be somewhat lacking as well. So I think, certainly for my segment, I tried to have a little bit of fun with it. My piece is sort of an homage to the slasher movies that I grew up with in the 80s. Like most of the Friday the 13th movies and The Burning and so on like that. So I wanted to take very stereotypical characters, like the cheerleader, the goth, the geek, and so on, and try and push them into a more realistic environment and see how far I could push that balance. So in a way, it was kind of just homaging and referencing a lot more fantasy than I'd seen in a lot of the kind of the newer found footage pieces.
Talk to me a little bit about how your idea kind of came to fruition. Has it sort of been inside of you for a while, this idea inside of your head, trying to come up with it? And tell me about the writing process and the directing process and how long that sort of took for you.
When I was first approached by the collective about VHS, They asked if I'd submit a slasher story, and that hadn't really been something that I'd been thinking about. I had originally submitted an outline for a segment about strange children with ESP in the 70s. So they got back and liked what I had submitted, but asked if I could do something more in the slasher mold. So I basically just started looking at a lot of this, my favorite slashes, my favorite being Jason Lives, Tom McLaughlin's Friday the 13th Part 6. And so I started to, you know, just write a very simple idea about kids going into the woods and basically wanted to put as many of the slasher conventions that I liked into the 15 minutes or so running time. And so I sat down, wrote the script, casted it up, and went out with the actors, and we adhered pretty closely to the script. By the time I got, you know, a couple of days later, it didn't take long to shoot, a couple of days later, I'm sitting in the edit room, and I didn't feel what I had was that authentic. And so I basically grabbed all the actors again, and we just started improvising it. I was lucky enough to be shooting in a friend's farm, and so, you know, we could quite easily go back up and just reshoot a bunch and have fun. And we all had felt that we'd workshopped the story and the characters enough so that basically, I mean, there's a scene in the car at the start of my segment where my only direction was to the actors to take the camera and go for a spin for 2 hours and just improv as the characters. And basically, once I got back to the editor room, it was pretty fresh to edit footage that I actually hadn't seen before. So it kind of it went from being a much more structured way of making a film, which is where I come from, to letting go and letting loose and just having fun with the actors with the improv.
I want to talk to you about your fellow directors on this project. Talk to me a little bit, if you can, about the collaborative process. Of course, all of you have your, you know, own little parts in this. How did you guys sort of discuss how that would fit into the whole of the film?
Well, we didn't. I think each of us pretty much worked in our own bubble. I'm on the East Coast, and I actually hadn't met Dave Bruckner or Radio Silence or even Adam Wingard. So I wasn't sure what each of them were doing, and I was kind of just going on what the collective and basically what Roxanne Benjamin was telling me the project would be all about. So it was a little bit vague, but it was a real pleasant surprise when I finally sat down and saw everything and felt that, you know, definitely fantasy kind of took over from the realness in a pretty progressive way. You know, for instance, with Dave Bruckner's piece at the start, I think it's really great that he's made a piece that starts out very, very real world and basically ends up a real triumph of fantasy. You know, I'm watching it and sitting there and thinking, oh my God, is this a date rape piece? You know, I don't really want to be watching this. And then he does a complete 360 and puts his foot down, and I think it really sets the tone for the rest of the movie that, you know, the rug is pulled from the audience a bit and the fantasy and escapism is let in.
When you were doing your segment, you mentioned to me how there was a lot of improvisation towards the end of it. When you're doing something like this, is it tricky to know how much time to fully invest in your characters when you have such a short amount of time? How do you sort of balance, you know, investing in the characters while also having time for the story as well?
Yeah, I think in workshopping and I think in the edit, a project like VHS afforded me the ability to go back and forth a little bit more from set to the edit than any other project I've ever been involved in. So I think more is always better, and then you can just trim down in the edit if you're feeling like, you know, you are just overstating a situation or a character. I think it's very important with found footage that you have to allow the audience to some gaps to fill in, because if you're painting everything just so, then it becomes slightly annoying. For instance, I think Ty's segment is pretty interesting because there's a lot more between Joe Swanberg and Sophia than you're really seeing on camera. But I think quite easily you know, you're filling in the gaps and knowing that maybe this guy is a bit of a jerk or whatever. But it's not said or shown in a really overt way. So I think it's important to not be too illustrative in your characters or situation in this format. So, but again, for me, being able to go back and forth from set to the edit allowed me to just tweak things just so if I felt anything was missing, or again to just chop out anything that I felt was, you know, too exploitative or too illustrative.
Mm-hmm. And a final question for you, Glenn, is you mentioned earlier in the interview, Jason Lives. I want to ask you a little bit about what were some of your favorite VHS films that you remember growing up watching in terms of the horror genre?
Cool. I suppose I was about 7 before a VHS player even entered our house. So it was kind of pre-VHS in a way. But when our VHS player arrived, it came free with a copy of The Wicker Man.
Oh, wow.
And I got to see the... I'll never forget, big, giant, white clamshell copy of The Wicker Man, and it was a movie that I thought was pretty kind of ridiculous and funny, because I probably saw it from 8 through to now, you know, I've watched it so many times, so that's a movie that's really stuck with me. It's a movie that I grew into. I didn't understand it. I just thought it was this kind of horny British musical romp that I didn't get at all. And then gradually over the years, I started to see the brilliance in it. I think what was wonderful about those times in general, and not just for VHS, is that you actively had to search out films. You know, for me to get my hands on a Lucio Fulci movie in Ireland in the early 80s was tough. You know, I couldn't afford the £80 or whatever it was to buy something like that, you know, so you had to go and find the right video shop with the right stock under the counter and stuff like that, and it was a real hunter-gatherer kind of vibe to it. I miss those days. I think the internet's made everything just way too easy. I mean,
yeah,
you can get your hands on whatever you want right now. Other movies like, you know, Friday the 13th Part 1, I remember very well watching that movie when I shouldn't have been. stuff like the Burning, The Howling, especially The Howling was a huge influence on me. I saw it way too young, but I wanted to be a werewolf for years after it. I really did.
With this VHS project, what do you feel that you bring to this project compared to the others?
Well, I'm definitely coming from a pretty different background than most of the other filmmakers, at least with the work that I've made previously. I don't know, hopefully my experience making, relationship movies and sort of emotionally based relationship stuff is that, you know, my segment of VHS, while hopefully scary, is also grounded in reality and has a relationship at the center of it that feels real and that people can connect to.
Was that sort of the, I guess, appeal for you, doing something like this, because it's not really something that you're really accustomed to?
Definitely. I mean, it had a lot of appeal to me for many reasons. I mean, it was a chance to do something short that was hopefully going to be seen by people in a feature context, which isn't always the case. You know, like if you make a short film, there's just still pretty limited ways that people see short films. It's not often that they go to the multiplex to watch a short film. So that was really exciting to, like, get to try something out in the short form that also was going to end up playing as a feature. And then, you know, I've really, in the last couple of years, been trying to challenge myself as a filmmaker to do things that I haven't done or that aren't, you know, sort of typical of my work, basically because I want to keep getting better at, you know, and keep practicing and trying different things. My biggest fear is to just end up making the same movie over and over, you know, that
right.
Or to like develop such a distinct style that it just starts to feel like a rehash of itself. So, you know, I'm trying to push outside of that a little bit. And also, it was sort of great fun to have the challenge of scaring people, you know, which is, it's not easy to do. You know, there's a lot of ways to go about it, but the end result either works or doesn't work. So that was kind of a cool challenge.
And you mentioned how you sort of have a background with doing this. Even though it's a different project, you do have an extensive background with doing low budgets, little time, and improvisation. Talk to me a little bit about how you used previous experiences on different films, which are different than this, while also sort of grounding them into the reality of scaring people in this film.
Sure. Well, you know, I definitely cast this film in the same way that I always do. I had seen Helen Rogers, who plays Emily, I had seen her in a short film called Block and I thought she was really amazing in it. And so I actually met with her on Skype for the first time, which has ended up being kind of ironic. and Daniel, who plays James, is a filmmaker friend of mine. You know, he's somebody who I got to know a little bit while he was in film school through another friend. And, you know, he's typically a director, but he does a little bit of acting. And that's something, you know, I tend to ask directors a lot to act in my stuff. So, you know, I basically, even though the material that we were shooting was, you know, intense and scary and involved special effects and all that kind of stuff, I tried to really, like, take the same attitude on set that I would on just a small movie and, you know, keep it light and work short days and go out to restaurants to eat rather than have, like, catering or craft services and things like that. You know, like, just a lot of the stuff that I like to do on any of my movies I did on this one. And also, you know, I've always been interested in technology and how it, you know, affects communication and relationships and things like that. So it was fun to continue that thread and sort of play around with Skype as a way for these characters to communicate.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about the found footage genre. Of course, we had it before with the Blair Witch Project and then Paranormal Activity, and now with this VHS film. Talk to me a little bit about what you see as the sort of appeal in these films.
Well, I think they work particularly well as horror films because your scope is limited as a viewer. Like, you're basically looking through the lens of a camera, which means there's always things to the right or the left or up or down that you can't see as a viewer, which I think immediately increases the tension of a movie. Whereas something that's shot from an omniscient point of view, you're very aware that the filmmaker is, you know, actively choosing to hide something from you, right? But when you feel like you're just the POV of the person holding the camera, you feel like anything could sneak up on you at any moment. And I think that that's a really scary feeling. And I feel like sound footage, what's sort of classified as sound footage, is also just a visual technique, you know? And I think that one of the fun things about VHS is that everybody's kind of like has their own take on it. It's not necessarily the idea of like, you know, a tape got discovered in the woods. It's more like just using that idea of the limited point of view as a visual aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the characters themselves, it's interesting when you're in a short film like this, which you have great experience in, but when you're doing something like this with a short film and other directors, how do you, I guess, find where you think your place is in a film like this with the rest of the story? Did you ever, I guess, have difficulty or trouble trying to figure out where you wanted, or where you guys all wanted to put your separate stories into one?
Well, the producers, Roxanne Benjamin and Brad Miska and Gary Vinkow, I think they made some really smart choices as producers on this movie. One of those choices was to not make everybody feel like they had to fit into a bigger overall structure. You know, there was a lot of freedom given to each team to make their movie. And, you know, the result of that, when I watched the finished movie, I feel like the result of that is a lot of cool crossover between the segments that gives the movie a unifying feeling, but then also all of the styles are different, you know, and everybody's kind of playing around with different things. So it was really fun because I didn't have to necessarily worry about, like, okay, well, I have the fourth segment, and it has to be this long, and it has to be, you know, this stuff has to happen because so-and-so is doing this thing in theirs. It was more like I just have the freedom to make my own film, and then those decisions, like the placement, which order the movies were in, and the themes and things like that, were decisions really made by the producers that weren't, like, put on us as filmmakers. So, I had one of the better experiences making this movie just because there was, like, so much freedom. I just felt completely capable of doing whatever I wanted, and then I felt like they would make those smart decisions later to make sure that it worked within the context of the whole project.
And for yourself, as a director and also a film fan, when you were growing up, what were some of your favorite VHS films that you remember watching?
Stand By Me is definitely, my grandma had that movie at her house on VHS, and I remember every time we'd go and visit her, I'd watch Stand By Me. So that's probably one of the movies I've seen the most in my life. Also, Raising Arizona was a big watch for me. It was one of the first movies that I bought. Then I worked at a video store in high school. I worked at Hollywood Video. So, when I think of VHS, I also think about, walking along. One of the things that we had to do at the video store was, take all the boxes and make sure that they were, like, properly centered and aligned and, like, up to the edge of the shelf and all that kind of stuff. So, whenever I think of VHS, I think about, hours and hours of my life in high school spent walking the rows of that Hollywood Video, like taking every box and like centering it and pulling it out to the edge of the shelf. So, I could probably tell you what the cover of almost any movie, what the VHS cover of almost any movie is, because I spent so much time looking at those boxes.
I used to work at Blockbuster, so I know all about it too, trust me. but all my stores are closed now, unfortunately.
I know. All the Hollywood Videos are closed, too.
And the next question for you is, as interesting with you doing this film, VHS, and having your own personal success, and also with the Duplass brothers having their success with Jeff Who Lives at Home and some other films that they've done, and Greta Gerwig with Greenberg. What has it been like for you to see all these people that you've worked with go to the next level?
Well, it's been really fun. I mean, part of what's cool about it is that, like, everybody's sort of been taking those steps to the next level together, you know? So it's been really a kind of fun, seamless transition from making really tiny movies together to starting to make bigger movies together. And it's cool, you know? Part of me... You know, I mean, the first time that I worked with Greta Gerwig, it seemed very obvious to me that she was a movie star and she ought to be really famous and acting in big movies, you know. So, part of it's validating to keep her getting that success. Another part of me feels like, why did it take so long? You know, like, I feel like...
Right.
I feel like when we shot Hannah Takes the Stairs in the summer of 2006, I was like, oh, my God, she's going to be, like, a movie star next year. But everything sort of, it has this kind of longer, more gradual progression to it, which is kind of nice, you know. I think that that's a little healthier and better than, like, overnight fame. It's been really great. I think it's also cool because, the stuff that we were sort of originally doing, the kind of, like, mumblecore stuff, it's been fun to see that, you know, infiltrating Hollywood a little bit. I think that, you know, the bigger budget movies, you know, stand to benefit a lot from some new ideas and different ways of making movies. So it's been really fun to sort of start to see that happen in the last couple of years.
Oh, of course. Have you seen a Safety Not Guaranteed yet?
No, I really want to see it because Jake Johnson from that movie just acted in my new movie, so I'm really excited to check it out.
And my final question for you is, when it comes to filmmakers, a term that they use a lot is passion. So I want to ask you, right now, you know, passion is something that can, you know, I guess go in spurts, sometimes really high, sometimes really low. Where do you gauge your passion right now at this stage in your career for films and filmmaking?
It's about as high as it's ever been. It definitely, like, took a dip for me in, like, 2008 and 2009, where I was, like, not very excited about making movies and really looking for other things to get me passionate. But lately, you know, starting in January, you know, at Sundance, like going to Sundance with VHS and having that incredible experience of showing the movie and having everybody react in such a big way to it. You know, this whole year has just been a really fun ride for me where I feel like I'm getting the opportunity to do a lot of things that I haven't been able to do before. So I'm excited and ready to make movies right now in a way that, you know, I haven't been all the time.
VHS. Watch it now on iTunes before it's in theaters. October 5th.
Okay, that was Glenn McQuaid and Joe Swanberg. The movie is VHS. It's currently available on demand, and it opens in select theaters on October 5th. Good job with that, Tony.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was good. I really like the what are your favorite VHS memories? Like the VHS tapes you used to own, what were your favorites when you were growing up? I like that question a lot.
Oh, thank you. I think it's interesting because, you know, now we're in the world of, you know, DVD and Blu-rays. I remember VHS used to be really expensive. I remember, like, going to, like, a Suncoast Video, and, you know, to get a new VHS tape, they used to be pretty expensive back in the day.
Like $90, $100, yeah.
To buy
Jerry, what are your, you know, we started actually with a beta machine before VHS came out.
An Itachi VHS, like the top loader, you know?
Uh-huh.
That was our first, like, foray in a home video. I mean, oh, my God. And I broke a copy of Angel Heart, and then I ran it from the video store, tore apart.
Oh, it was easy to do that with the actual tape, like getting stuck in there and jammed and twisted.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was.
Yeah, I remember that beta machine was badass, though. I mean, it weighed a ton. And, I mean, it had, like, a joggle fast-forward and rewind on it. It had a slow freeze frame and different frame rates you could play it at. I mean, it was, like, fancy schmancy. And the first movies that we rented for it were some Charles Bronson movie that I can't remember.
White Buffalo?
No, not that good. And and Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins.
Oh, that's a – you can't go wrong with Remo Williams. I'm sorry. I like Remo Williams.
That's a good memory. It's a good memory. And VHS, you know, I remember the – and one of the guests alluded to it, the big clamshell cases.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, VHS were great.
I think there's something missing without having VHS tapes. I guess just the idea of, like, a video store in general, because it's like – I know there's the you know, like on Netflix now and the internet, but I think there's something special about being able to, you know, walk into a video store and kind of, you know, clone the shelves and kind of unread the box and see what's out there.
Mm-hmm. I do too. So good interviews. Hey, future shows. We've got a couple of future shows coming up. We're going to cover the New York Film Festival in the near future. Also, I'm trying to figure out how to do a celebration of James Bond, because not only is Skyfall coming out in early November, but it's also the 50th anniversary of the release of Dr. No, which was the first Bond movie, right?
Mm-hmm. I can do that every day of the year.
So let's do that together.
I'm all for that. I could talk about that endlessly. So
we'll do a Bond series, an ongoing Bond
series. Yeah,
we'll
do a Bond series. I could be all that you need.
Okay. There's 50 years of history here, so there's a lot of guests that I can reach out to, and I'm trying to reach out to.
Oh, yeah, I mean –
as many as possible. But if I can't get any, I expect you to pretend like you're a Bond girl for one of the shows.
Oh, yeah, I'd do that. I mean, I think at one time I still would like to. Yeah, never mind. We won't go there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I love Eric, can I say this? I love all the Bond girls. There you go.
Yeah, Jerry, you are my pussy galore. Let me just.
Oh, thank you so much. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
Okay, so James Bond coming up. That'll be in late October, I think. So, we're going to close out the show tonight with Cliff Martinez, a new score by him. Tony.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us, buddy. It's been fun.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
No, thank you, Tony. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for your wonderful.
It was an honor to be on here.
Anytime. And then thank you for your wonderful interviews that you do for
us.
Yes,
thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to do them. Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, tonight's movie score is Cliff Martinez. It's the new film, Arbitrage, starring Richard Gere.
Oh, I can't wait to see this. Okay, cool.
It's gotten good reviews. It's getting good notices. Arbitrage, a movie that Pacino signed up for and then backed out of to be replaced by Richard Gere. Richard Gere like had a couple of weeks' notice, I think, after Pacino dropped out. Did you know that? There you go.
No, I didn't know that. I thought Hugh Laurie was originally supposed to be in it.
Yeah. That damn Hugh Laurie. All right. Here's Arbitrage, guys. Good night, everybody. We'll see you back here Wednesday night.
Good night.
Bye. Take care.